right, y'all. Welcome to the Scott Horton Show. I am the director of the Libertarian Institute, editorial director of antiwar.com, author of the book Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan, and I've recorded more than 5,000 interviews going back to 2003, all of which are available at scotthorton.org. You can also sign up for the podcast feed. The full archive is also available at youtube.com/ScottHortonShow. All right, you guys, introducing everybody's favorite SpaghettiO on Twitter, Peter Lee, the China Hand. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
It's great to be here, Scott.
Great to talk to you again. And everybody, you know what you can do is you can find Peter Lee's China Threat Report on Patreon, patreon.com, and also on his blog, which I can't find the tab for at the moment. But it's the China Hand blog. What's the URL for that? I'm sorry.
It's China Matters, but I must confess I don't update that anymore. I do everything on my Patreon.
Okay, great. But there's lots of old stuff to read there.
So. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
it's my golden oldies.
So I read parts 1 through 6, I guess, last night, man, catching up on this Uyghur thing. Boy, do I gotta turn over to my giant page of notes here. The question is in regards to the Xinjiang Uyghurs. And by the way, I just got off the line right before you one moment ago with Larry Wilkerson, and he had some things to add to this, but I'll bring those up later. First of all, can you just, let me say, I can tell from your writing here that you've been writing all about this for a very long time before it was a big fad and a war party talking point and all of this. So the purpose of this is just to get to exactly what is the truth about the Chinese government's persecution of the Uyghurs and what ain't true and all of that. So first of all, what's a Uyghur and what's a Xinjiang province and how do I get there from here?
Okay, so a big swath of northwest China is the Xinjiang Autonomous Region of the People's Republic of China. It's about, there are 10 million or so people of Uyghur ethnicity out there, which is a Turkic Muslim ethnicity. And probably by now there's somewhere around the same number of Han Chinese who have moved in as immigrants or been there for a while. It's always been the Chinese frontier. In fact, as I'm sure your educated readers know, the word Xinjiang means new frontier. And incorporation of Xinjiang into the Chinese empires has always been a problematic issue, even up to and including the present day. So the current ruckus about the Uyghurs has to do with the fact that the People's Republic of China under Xi Jinping has pretty much abandoned its previous laissez-faire policy toward letting Xinjiang sort of drift along, and they are working aggressively to incorporate Xinjiang into the People's Republic of China and integrate the Uyghurs into Chinese society.
Mm-hmm. And then, so to cut right to the chase, the U.S. government says that's genocide. Is that right?
Yeah. it's not genocide. Well, there's two angles to this thing. The first thing is that, of course, there's in the popular conception, genocide means herding people into camps based upon an ethnic identity and murdering them. The second part is not going on. Even Team Uyghur, the people determined to advertise the sufferings of the Uyghurs in China, have not made any claims of mass executions. What makes it a little more complicated is, as I put it on Twitter a while back, genocide convictions are like what we say in the United States about a grand jury. You know, it can indict a ham sandwich. And the genocide laws are, the genocide case law is vague enough that pretty much anything that you do out there could be construed as genocide. Basically, the 1948 Genocide Convention defines genocide in several ways above and beyond, the mass killings of people. It does not include cultural genocide, which is what the Chinese program in in Xinjiang looks a lot like. It does, however, allow for convictions of genocide on the idea of restriction of birth rates and reproduction. And Adrian Zenz came out with a rather, to me, convoluted and unconvincing statistical massage, where he tried to claim that the Chinese were practicing reproductive genocide out there in Xinjiang. So, you know, it really depends on the venue where you go in, and who the judges are in that. So, you know, if they're willing to take Chinese side, it would be not genocide. But if they're going to take Adrian Zenz's side, then it is genocide.
Yeah. Well, and then, I mean, the question of Zenz brings up of whether his stats are completely wrong or somewhat close or what. Okay, so here's a good way to get into this. How many people do you think are in these so-called camps, and just what is it like in there?
Well, A, nobody knows how many people are in the camps out there. The numbers have been thrown around. What's in something of an Adrian Zenz special, you know, when he gives his, when he puts out his estimates, he said up to 1 million. And then, of course, the up to qualifier was dropped out and everybody ran with 1 million. And then he said maybe 2 to 3. They drop out the maybe. And so now it's 2 to 3 million. I tend to doubt that there's as many as 1 million people in the camps. That would be 10% of the Uyghur population. A lot of hay has been made in the Uyghur sphere using satellite photographs to identify detention facilities and extrapolate from that the number of people who are currently detained. But the problem with that is that when China embarks upon one of these extensive programs, everybody gets money and everybody starts building. But exactly how many people were held in those camps, and how many have actually been cycled through the system and released into society or into factories or something like that is something that nobody knows. But I think that one of the issues is that the Chinese government always regarded these camps as an arena for education, socialization, training, and eventually emptying out the camps and releasing the Uyghurs to a new lifestyle, which is more urban, embedded in the factory system, and not rural, peasanty, and liable to be more amenable to subversion and more conservative Islamic practice. Mm-hmm. So, long story short, is the thing that always bugged me about the data that I was able to look at is that, it's either from 2017 or 2018, or it doesn't have dates on it at all. So there's really no good time-related thing that I've seen that talks about the levels of people detained in the camps and how many have actually come out.
Hmm. Well, and it sounds like you're saying, too, that this is part of the overall policy of building giant cities and then forcing millions of peasants from the countryside to move there and try to somehow make it work.
Well, the Chinese have been puzzling over the Xinjiang issue for a while. The main problem is in the oasis cities of southern Xinjiang. Northern Xinjiang is not a traditional Uyghur homeland. The main action is down in the south, and it's poor. And, they tried this thing of bootstrapping and, laissez-faire and the issues of, economic activity and that sort of stuff. But what happened instead was that, the Xinjiang, from the PRC point of view, turned into a major governance crisis. The Chinese like to talk about terrorist activity there, which means, stuff that Islamists, with a jihadi bent are doing down there in terms of violence against state targets. But that's just the tip of the iceberg. There was a lot of poor government, a lot of dissatisfaction, a lot of local hacking and chopping. And so the Chinese idea is that this whole program that they're doing down there is part of an overall effort to not only increase the government's reach into the daily lives of Uyghurs, but also to improve governments and, you know, try to attain a higher level of Uyghur loyalty to the PRC via that method.
Hey, y'all, let me tell you about the Libertarian Institute's latest book, What Social Animals Owe to Each Other, by our executive editor, the great Sheldon Richman. For decades, Richman has been explaining libertarianism to the left from the left. He makes a strong case that any honest liberal, progressive, or leftist actually should be libertarians, since in fact it is freedom itself that provides what y'all want. Richman argues the case for liberty and peace, the human spirit and social cooperation, for true liberalism, libertarianism, against the corrupt forces of statism, corporatism, and violence. What Social Animals Owe to Each Other by Sheldon Richman. Now available at libertarianinstitute.org/books. Hey guys, Scott Horton here for Mike Swanson's great book, The War State. It's about the rise of the military-industrial complex and the power elite after World War II, during the administrations of Harry Truman, Dwight Eisenhower, and Jack Kennedy. It's a very enlightening take on this definitive era on America's road to world empire. The War State by Mike Swanson. Find it in the right-hand margin at scotthorton.org.
All right, so I guess part of the Adrian Zen stuff was, you know, really focused on birth control. And the idea was that they were, that the Uyghur women were being forced to get these IUD implants or whatever, that kind of thing. And it seems like, well, because it is government health care, there is a question of just how free the people are when their doctor's a cop to tell him no, or whether that. So in other words, if you just made more birth control available to people in a free society, there wouldn't really be a question there. But it's not a free society in the first place. So then the question is, are they forcing these women to get these IUD implants, and especially in these massive numbers, the way that he claims? So that way they're not, you know, rounding people up in camps. They're just preventing them from ever being born, this kind of thing.
Yeah, well, you know, the Gareth Porter caught Zenz out on a on his bad math and his miscalculation, where he radically overestimated the number of people and the rate of IUD insertion in Xinjiang. And actually, Zenz quietly retracted that a while back. Actually, yesterday, I think it was.
Oh, really?
I'll have to dig out the link and put it on my
I saw him threatening to sue Landis for tweeting it.
He is.
I mean, that was a few weeks back, I guess, when the article first came out. We're talking about Gareth Porter, Max Blumenthal in the Gray Zone, regarding Adrian Zenz. Those are your search terms, everybody.
Yeah.
If you're trying
to catch
up here.
I saw yesterday on Twitter that he had quietly made a correction to one of his materials relating to the level of IUD insertion. The birth control priorities have less to do with controlling the overall growth of Uyghur population than trying to reduce the number of children in peasant families. Again, as part of this thing where, you know, if you're a poor sod buster, you're just cranking out the kids, you know, to provide social security and work in the fields. But if you have a prosperous factory job and you want to go out dancing, you're only going to have one kid. Mm-hmm. So certainly from the point of view of the Chinese government, it is preferred that rural women in Xinjiang, you know, will get IUDs put into them, and I wouldn't be surprised if there was some coercive thing to it. But it's like I said, it's probably has to do with you know, coercive birth control in certain rural contexts, rather than an overall desire to control Uyghur numbers. They'll be happy to have lots of Uyghurs as long as they're docile, urbanized, and working in the factory.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, listen, I mean, there's a huge fad going on right now about being very, very concerned about this. And I've seen, you know, plenty of people, even libertarians, saying, oh, no, we said never again. And yet here we are turning away from it happening again, when, I mean, clearly they don't know anything about it other than it's a big fad to be very, very concerned about this right now. What's behind that, do you think? Is it something happened? It's just Adrian Zenz put out a report that got him on Democracy Now? Or
well, I should say is that, for me, in terms of outrages committed by governments against civilian Muslim populations, I doubt that the Uyghurs' plight would make it into my top five. You know, I think of things like Palestine, I think of things like Yemen, Libya, Syria, the Rohingya. And the thing that's the closest analog to what China is doing, which is the Indian security operation in Jammu and Kashmir. So, yeah, I know I am rather bemused at the fervor in which with which the Uyghur cause has been taken up. But you know, it's obviously it's an orchestrated thing to go after China and strip it of its allies and help with the whole economic decoupling thing. And the United States has been quietly nudging along with the Uyghur aspirations for decades, in terms of harboring Uyghurs from Rabia Kadir on down and, providing funding to the World Uyghur Congress and that. So it's always been a project, just like, we always keep, Tibetan emigres, on the string so that if and when it becomes there's a chance to turn the crank, and scale it up into a bigger campaign. We go ahead and do that. Right. And I think that the core reason why we decided to unleash the hounds on the Chinese over the Uyghurs was a couple things. The first of one is that we were staying our hand because the United States was committed itself to a narrative of Islamic unrest and security threats, and the Chinese piggybacked on that and was harder for us to go after that until, of course, we decided that the global war on terror was bygones and it was time to switch to China containment as the China is the main security threat that we're facing. And so it's no coincidence that as we pivoted towards China as the health of the state, for for the military-industrial complex, that the Uyghurs, which are were considered to be a rather useful resource for us in terms of public opinion and potentially subversion in China, got pushed to the front.
Mm-hmm. Well, so I was just talking with Larry Wilkerson, and he was clarifying that, that's Colonel Larry Wilkerson, U.S. Army, retired, Colin Powell's former chief of staff, making up for it ever since. Anyway, he gave this speech where he said something about American support for these guys. The intel guys think it's smart. They can use the Uyghurs against the Chinese. And he clarified that he was saying in the event of a major war, we would put them into action. He's not accusing them of using, the CIA being behind anything going on with the Uyghurs in Xinjiang now. But he did say that apparently he knows that the Uyghur fighters, by some counts, thousands of them who went to fight under Turkish control and allied with the CIA and Al-Qaeda in the war in Syria, which you've written about in some detail, that they're now coming home and that the Chinese are very worried about what they're going to do and whose control they might be under.
Yeah, Recep Erdogan, he had a whole rat line, as Seymour Hersh called it, of exfiltrating Uyghurs to Turkey and then onward to Syria. And now there's a nice little colony. He actually gave them their own town in Idlib, which they run. And, when it was thought that we would actually let Syria recover Idlib, there was a lot of concern about where those guys were going to end up. And it was pretty obvious that they were not going to go back to Turkey. They would probably try to sneak him into Afghanistan, sort of close to home. Now that it seems that Idlib is going to be a permanent feature of, as an independent enclave, those Uyghurs, I think for the most part, are staying put. But Afghanistan is, the obvious venue for it, not only because it's next to Xinjiang, but also because the Taliban has had a covert you know, alliance with Al Qaeda, and most of these guys fall on the Al Qaeda side of the fence. You know, in Pakistan, in Afghanistan, excuse me, they've been quite ferocious about repressing ISIS. But I think the idea with the Uyghurs was, you know, they were kind of, they came in there, they, you know, they were part of the IQ system, and, you know, the Taliban says, you know, don't make trouble here, go over to Syria and kill somebody. So, you know, there is the definite possibility that they will come back. And I would think that, you know, under the right circumstances, they would not necessarily be using Afghanistan as an active base to attack Xinjiang. I think it's more likely that they would be warehoused there, you know, against, you know, a future opportunity. And in terms of the enough already thing, I'd be interested to, you know, to get your thoughts on it. I don't think we're ever leaving Afghanistan for the reason that it's not only because it's a nice American foothold in Central Asia, but also the Pentagon is pretty much under the sway of the pro-Indian as well as pro-Japanese factions there. And giving up Afghanistan to the Taliban, and that means to Pakistan, is something that India abhors. Right. And I think that in the debates in the Pentagon, they're probably saying, well, you know, we can't screw over India by leaving Afghanistan to the Taliban, so we better stick around and keep stirring things up there.
Hey, you guys, Scott here. Over the next few years, I'm going to be more and more involved in Libertarian Party politics. But I can't put that stuff out on the Libertarian Institute feed because of the 501c3 rules and all that. Got to keep them separated. So, interestingly enough, paradoxically enough, if you want to learn all about the Libertarian Party stuff that I'm involved in and listen to those interviews, you're going to have to sign up to the ScottHorton.org feed. And if you want to just listen to good old foreign policy stuff and not have to worry about all this LP stuff, then you go ahead and subscribe to the show at the Libertarian Institute, and it will be LP politics free for you there. And we'd like to thank you for your support. So in terms of all this great game stuff and preventing China from building their highway through and all these kinds of things, I mean, to me, that's just completely crazy, and just the fact that anyone would even entertain that as a worth it, you know, as a worthy policy is just, even from an imperialist point of view, the costs are not worth it. One thing that he said to me that did make sense from the Pentagon's point of view, not from mine, but at least is reasonable, is that they need to stay there in the event they need to seize Pakistani nukes. And I pressed him on that and said, why can't they just do that from the Indian Ocean, you know? And he says, because from the Bagram Air Base, they can invade and they can send reinforcements in a way that you can't just do with Navy ships. So in other words, it wouldn't just be special operations forces preventing a couple of kooks from getting a couple of nukes. The idea would be a full-scale invasion of Pakistan if worse came to worse and they were going to use their nukes against India, I guess. We try to invade and prevent that from happening. And so, and that still sounds like a line of BS to me in a way.
Yeah.
But I can see them convincing themselves of that anyway, you know.
Yeah. Well, you know, that gives a compelling official rationale. By the way, do you recall in G.I. Joe, The Rise of Cobra, that the movie started with, you know, a seizure of nukes? I think it was from Pakistan.
Yeah.
By the Joes.
That's funny. You know?
So why don't we just put them on the case?
Yeah, I don't know. It seems like a good idea. I mean, Ronald Reagan at least turned a blind eye to them building nukes the whole time when he could have stopped them. Hell, the CIA turned a blind eye to AQ Khan when he stole the blueprints from them centrifuges in the first place. Hey, let's see where he goes. Let's see what he does. Oh, he went straight to a photocopy machine. Oh, no. Anyway, you know, there's always an American antecedent to all of this stuff. Always. All right, so there's so many issues here, but back to the whether either of us are apologists for a genocide or just how bad it really is. It sounds like it's pretty bad I mean, are people rushing to line up to go to the work camp, or they're being rousted out of their homes by armed gunmen, or what is going on here, you know?
Yeah, well, there's a three-tier system there. I'm pretty sure it's three tiers. But under the, you know, there's of course, you know, formal incarceration for people who have actually committed acts, you know, that are criminal under the terrorism law. And but also at the lower end of the spectrum, there's something that I would characterize as under the terrorism law as supervision. And you know, that means that if you're deemed to be to have been tainted by you know, Islamist or separatist thoughts, then you're invited to go to a camp and receive indoctrination for a couple years. So exactly, you know, probably, you know, the way the Chinese work is that you know, there's not an official quota system, you know, but you know, it's probably something more like in the lines of if you haven't been in this area, if you haven't cycled like 10% of the population through the camp, you know, they're probably going to be asking the local boss man if he's being too lax.
Yeah.
And they probably go in there and, you know, with, you know, denunciations and administrative procedures to push up the numbers. So,
well, you know, you talked about how their kind of laissez-faire approach before kind of backfired because people just got rich and stronger and more independent from them. So, oops, now we're trying to clamp down. But it seems like if you round up a bunch of people and put them in these brainwashing camps and things, that would just make them angry. I mean, brainwashing doesn't really work, right? That's not really a thing.
It seems like I said, I don't think that, by the way, one thing I should say is that I think one of the areas that makes the United States and others extremely nervous is that China has studied every other coin and reprogramming and incarceration thing. You know, everybody's doing it. I mean, the Saudis have a big program right now. The French are trying to, you know, to institute, you know, de-Islamization stuff. You know, we did a great job at Abu Ghraib. And, you know, there's Chechnya and there's Kashmir. The Chinese have looked at all of this. And
foreignpolicy.com, they say the entire American right has got to go through this, their de-radicalization program. Yeah.
China's got the experience. And I think what scares the United States is there's a good chance that for the Chinese it'll work. Because it's not because the Chinese are smarter, but they have looked at the previous errors, which are reef, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, a lot of errors, and also they're putting massive resources in there. So, you know,
I think it's rife.
Rife. Thank you. So anyway, so you know, I think what scares them is that the idea is that, yes, you know, the Xinjiang population will become docile and tractable, you know. And, you know, what do we do then?
Yeah. How are we supposed to use them in a war if this works?
you know. They have a whole, you know, the Chinese have this whole, this new ethnic policy theory and all this sort of stuff that's feeding into that. And, the West has not been putting the points up on the board when it comes to de-radicalization. And the Chinese, I think they think they have a pretty good chance. So it's not just, you know, brainwashing. The whole idea is to remake the economic and social matrix of Xinjiang so that the things that fed into these attitudes and these resentments, they'll be removed from that context. And they'll be put into a new context where they'll be getting better paid, they'll have better work, and their material conditions will improve. And within the bounds of the current system, they'll have, you know, greater mobility. So that's the thing. For the Chinese, the camps, you know, the re-education or training camps are, you know, just one link in a holistic program to remake Xinjiang's society. I think it's one of the bigger social engineering programs ever attempted in modern history.
Crazy. Well, and I mean, it certainly sounds like the end result would be wiping out a way of life, if not all the people who lived it.
Well, you know, I would say that as far, you know, like the Chinese, you know, stay away from the whole cultural genocide thing. You know, they've always got happy Uyghurs dancing and that sort of stuff. But in terms of, you know, by the way, it's a rather astounding statistic that, you know, I think it's like 700 million people in China have moved overall, have moved from agricultural and rural to urban and semi-urban contexts over the years of reform. Same thing's happening in Tibet. Same thing's going to happen in Xinjiang. You're going to have fewer sod busters and nomads. And that, to the Chinese, you know, with the improved living standards and social services and retirement benefits and healthcare and all that stuff, is what they define as progress. So, yeah, you know, the I would say that the traditional ways of life associated with Uyghur ethnic culture are definitely at risk. But by the way, one thing I mentioned in one of my pieces is that you probably remember why cultural genocide is not in the Genocide Convention was that Canada insisted that it be removed because they had an ongoing program of forced removal of First Nation children to church-run religious schools in the 1950s, in the 40s and 50s, when the Genocide Convention was being negotiated. Mm-hmm. Genocide accusations are not retrospective or retroactive, but at the time that the Genocide Convention was being fixed, Canada had a explicit program of cultural genocide for its First Nations.
Yeah. Again, the American antecedent there. North American. Listen, I'm sorry. I'm all out of time and I got to go, but thank you so much. That's the China Hand, everybody. Peter Lee, check out the China Threat Report. Peter Lee's China Threat Report at patreon.com. Really appreciate it, man.
Okay. I also just want to add that I give it away free on Twitter at China Hand. So
oh,
you
yeah.
can also follow
I
me there.
I should have said that there. Yeah. At China Hand, your favorite SpaghettiO. That's how you know you found your guy there. All right. Appreciate that, man.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Scott.
The Scott Horton Show, Anti-War Radio, can be heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, APSradio.com, antiwar.com, scotthorton.org, and libertarianinstitute.org.